This is Living Lab Radio. I'm Heather Goldstone. We're all connected to the ocean in some way, but we all feel that connection in different ways. A survey launching this week aims to understand some of those differences. Also, have you ever wondered who first had the idea of drinking fruit juice that had fermented? An archaeologist of fermented beverages says drinking alcohol goes all the way back to our primate ancestors, and the act of creating such brews is many thousands of years old. That's all coming up later this hour. First, Americans have been getting a crash course in cybersecurity in recent weeks. Ransomware attacks have crippled everything from traffic cameras in Australia to multi-billion dollar international companies, healthcare networks, even the Ukrainian electricity grid. Analysts have called the attacks worrisome, concerning, and other adjectives clearly intended to not cause mass hysteria, but they also warn that attacks are likely to continue and get worse. My next guest is one of the authors of a recent report that proposed federal policies and a research agenda to improve the security of America's critical systems. Joel Brenner is a senior research fellow at MIT's Internet Policy Research Initiative. He's the former head of counterintelligence and the former inspector general of the NSA. He joins me now via Skype. Joel, welcome to Living Lab Radio.
Thanks, Heather. It's great to be with you.
Now, the internet, for most of us, is a great way to get the news, to browse Facebook, but it has also become integral to some of our most critical infrastructure, everything from healthcare to energy, communications, transportation. And in fact, you say there's kind of been this expansion. We're up to 16 critical infrastructure systems that need the internet. And you kind of make the distinction between critical and really critical. So what's in that really critical category?
The really critical categories, Heather, are energy, particularly electricity, followed by communications, finance, and transportation. A successful attack on any of those sectors would have catastrophic spillover effects, economic and human, across all sectors of the economy. That would be really serious. And those sectors are, like all critical sectors, are overwhelmingly in private hands. And so the government can't just give instructions to the owners and operators of those systems as to what to do. So we really are at a juncture of having to think through how do we affect those systems that have widespread, clearly national security effects for everyone.
The idea of cybersecurity and cyber attacks is not a new one for experts like yourself. It's something that you've been warning about really for decades. How did we get to the point where we've been this spring with these intense, you know, national level attacks of ransomware? Why are we so vulnerable if we've known that this is a possibility for so long?
Well, let's go back to the origins of the thing we call the internet. Of course, when most people talk about the internet, they mean everything they do on their computer. But the internet is really only a way of sending information in packets around electronic space according to certain protocols for how those messages are going to be sent and managed. The origin of it goes way back to the 60s to the Defense Department, which was concerned that in a nuclear war, how would the president be able to communicate? How would he give instructions or get information from his commanders and so on, from the Secretary of Defense? That originally was intended only for secure use among a small number of government officials. It then was adapted for wider use in the scientific community, but again, in only a limited way for scientists in the Pentagon and at a few universities like MIT and Stanford. And there again, you had a trusted group of individuals who were using this device only for scientific communications. And what will really astonish many of your listeners, Heather, is that until 1992, it was against the law to use the internet for anything having to do with commerce. So when the internet was originally designed, it didn't have security built into it. There was no need for it. A lot of the people who were using it had security clearances, and most of them knew one another. But when we took that system, in which identities are easily spoofed, for example, and we blew up the dam between it and commerce, we then used it as the backbone for national and international finance, for military communications, and for virtually everything we do. And it not only information uses, but now operating technology works on it, so that the heating and ventilation in the room you're in now at the studio, or in anybody's workplace, and telephone switches and railway switches and air traffic control and everything, manufacturing controls, are all digitized and exposed to the internet. So that's how we got here. We took a system that brought us wonderful efficiencies and much pleasure and creativity, and whose efficiencies and so on were immediately obvious, but it had vulnerabilities that were not immediately obvious except to experts. And we've used it as the backbone for everything. So that's, in short, how we got here.
Now, you were part of a recent workshop at MIT that actually brought together representatives from some of these industries that you've been talking about, along with academic researchers and a few government representatives. And one of the top recommendations coming out of that workshop was that some critical controls in these critical service industries are going to have to be isolated from the internet. That seems to suggest that, to a certain extent, there's no way to fix what you were just talking about with, some of the built-in vulnerabilities in the internet, and we're just going to have to wall off certain things from the internet. How much agreement is there about that, and how much walling off are we talking about?
Well, we don't know yet how much agreement there is. I think there will be considerable opposition to it because it will be costly. Let me put the basic problem this way. I've described to you a terribly insecure system. We know that. So the question that people are asking themselves is, how can we take things that are critical to protect, expose them to what we know is an insecure system, and make them secure? We don't think you can square that circle. That merely stating the question that way tells you that it can't be done. Now, having said that, isolation is a relative matter, and there's lots of room for disagreement about it. But people should understand that not many years ago, the control on a track that carried a freight train was locked up in a room that only an engineer could go to in one place to make that, to move that switch. Same thing for electricity controls at a substation or a generating station. These controls were meant to be physically protected. Now, we've gone and retrofitted those controls with digitized, with that technology. We've retrofitted the technology with digitized controls. That means that they can be reached and attacked from almost anywhere. So what we're saying is, if you really want to protect that stuff, if you want to make it so that somebody overseas can't attack an energy generation or transmission plant in Montana or California, if you want to make sure that the switches can't be manipulated to cause a train track from some other country, then you have to re-isolate those to some significant degree. I think there will be opposition to this, but I don't think there is. We found no disagreement about it among the experts who came to our workshops to develop these recommendations. And I don't say that their companies would all agree, but the security people in those companies agree. You can't get secure unless you protect this stuff much better.
I'm guessing you would get a lot of pushback from the consumer electronics industry, because, of course, that whole industry is moving in exactly the opposite direction. We're now moving into the Internet of Things, where almost everything around us, our thermostat, our phone, you know, everything is connected to the internet. All of these devices are talking to each other and back to potentially controllers some other place. And we don't necessarily even know what the code or whatever is that's inside these different devices. How vulnerable is the Internet of Things?
Well, the Internet of Things, so-called, presents different issues than controls. We're not talking about taking everything undigitizing everything and going back to 1980s analog technology. That's not the suggestion. The suggestion is that certain key controls, which need to be identified on a industry by industry basis, ought to be isolated. Now, to come back to your question on the so-called IoT or Internet of Things, people have marketed these devices like thermostats in houses or surveillance cameras that are all running on the internet and that have no security in them. A few months ago, we had an attack on a major, what's called a domain name system participant that basically took down the internet in parts of Europe and good parts of the eastern United States for quite a while. And it was enabled through what's called a botnet, which is a robotically controlled conglomeration of computers all over the place that ran through security cameras that had no security. And these are the kind of security cameras you might see in a bank or a grocery store, even, or in your own house if you want to see the babysitter while you're at dinner, at a restaurant. These had no security in them at all. They were organized without the understanding and knowledge of their owners into a huge botnet, which then flooded this company called Dyn in New Hampshire with traffic that's called a distributed denial of service attack, which took the parts of the internet down. Now, if we had rules that a manufacturer of security cameras that had no security in it, it didn't follow basic security standards, would be liable to third parties for the damage it caused, those cameras would be withdrawn from the market before the end of, before the middle of next week. It would happen that fast. Nobody could stand that liability. But right now, we're operating in this bizarre situation in which only hardware and software can be put into the market insecurely and have no liability consequences. Heather, I can't think of any other area of social and economic life where you can sell insecure or unsuitable goods and services into the stream of commerce and face no liability for it. That is not only anomalous, I think it's untenable. It's got to change.
In case you're just joining us, I'm talking with Joel Brenner about cybersecurity or the lack thereof. The workshop recommendations that came out included, as we said, some degree of isolation, but then a lot of it was really focused on federal policies, recommendations that were aimed directly at the president for actions that could be taken. And in fact, President Trump has issued an executive order on the issue of cybersecurity recently. I wonder how what he has done compares with what this workshop of experts was recommending.
Well, the drafts of that order were interesting because they said nothing at all about critical infrastructure and only addressed federal systems. And then once our report came out, the final version of the executive order said much, much more about critical infrastructure. And we like to think we might have influenced that, but we don't really know. But that order falls in two parts, Heather. The first part, which is the most robust, deals only with federal systems. And it requires that they be managed on an enterprise basis, that's to say across the whole federal government rather than with departmental fiefdoms, each one going its own way. And that's a good order in our view, quite a good order. The second part of the order does deal with critical infrastructure, but it's less sure-footed than the first part of the order. And it basically creates a number of cabinet-level study groups to examine issues such as those we raised. We hope now that our report with its recommendations will be helpful to those cabinet-level study groups and to the cabinet officers, secretaries who have to come back to the president with specific recommendations. So, in short, The first part of the order on federal systems was very specific and I think very good. The second part on critical infrastructure, I think, reflected the knowledge they hadn't paid enough attention to it, but pushed a lot of issues into accelerated study groups rather than made specific policy decisions themselves.
We've heard from the science community a lot in the past few months that environmental policy in particular, but a lot of science-based policy in the Trump administration is being set without much input from scientists and science advisors. I mean, you're saying your report, this workshop, may have influenced the Trump administration's executive order in this case, but do you feel like that's also true of cybersecurity policy, that does the Trump administration have the experts and the advisors that they need to be setting this kind of policy?
Well, there are some good people now in the administration in cybersecurity, including a former colleague of mine from NSA, Rob Joyce, who's now the principal advisor. I think the administration has become serious about this early in its term, which, you know, the Obama administration eventually got serious about cybersecurity, but it took it 7 years. Same thing with the Bush administration. I don't want to get off into general comments about this administration right now. I only want to talk about this area. In this area, they've said a lot of the right things. Now, it remains to be seen how they follow through. As you know, in all these areas, the truth is in the follow through. They got a good recipe. Let's see what they actually cook.
Joel Brenner is a senior research fellow at MIT's Internet Policy Research Initiative. He'll be at the Waterfront Grill in New Bedford tomorrow night, July 11th at 6 p.m., talking about how to make our critical infrastructure more secure. You can find more information about that event on our website, capeandislands.org. Joel, thanks so much for talking with us.
Oh, it's been great to be with you, Heather.
Up next, dive into the ancient history of fermented beverages, beer, wine, mead, even a combination of all three. Living Lab Radio continues after a short break.